This is episode 88 with Derek Sivers. Welcome to The Art of Adventure, the show that breaks down how to do something that has never been done before. I'm your host, lead explorer and guide, Derek Loudermilk. You can check out all the show notes and articles of The Art of Adventure on DerekLoudermilk.com. In today's episode, we have Derek Sivers, founder of CD Baby, best-selling author, frequent TED speaker. He is on the show joining us from windy Wellington, New Zealand. And tons of people email Derek for advice. And today, we're going to distill some of that, his best thoughts on career building and discovering purpose from your work rather than the other way around. He also has this great new project where he shares simple one-sentence directives that he has condensed from over 225 books that he has read over the last 7 years. So the category that he shares with us, there's several directives, is how to get rich. This is almost like his version of the Ten Commandments for how to get rich. We riff on the power of location, you know, where you live, how it influences your work. And because he's a known introvert, we talk about the differences working as an introvert or an extrovert. And this is very special for me. I've been a huge fan of Derek's for a long time, and he doesn't give a lot of interviews. So this is a special and rare moment. Don't want you to miss any of it. So let's get right into it. Really excited today because this is a momentous occasion. This is the first time we have another Derek on the show, spelled the same way, so you know it's the right way. Derek Sivers is the founder of CD Baby. He started that company and sold it for lots of money. He is a frequent speaker at TED conferences. There's some great ones that I'll have linked in the show notes. He's done all kinds of things. He has the Wood Egg Startup Guides for Southeast Asia, of which I read the one for Vietnam when I went there. He does some programming. He does a lot of reading and publishes his notes on the books he reads. He's written a best-selling book himself, Anything You Want. And we caught up in Wellington, New Zealand when I was there. There's lots more to say about him, but here is Derek Sivers. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Derek.
What a list of cool things that you've done. Another thing that I didn't mention is that you write publicly on your website that you are an introvert and you don't do a lot of interviews. So this is a very special, rare unicorn to have you on, the podcast. And one of the things you do is you help a lot of people, random people that you don't know, that send you emails, just like I did several years ago. And that's pretty rare, mm-hmm. I think. Why did you decide that was your way that you wanted to be altruistic, I guess?
It seems like manners to me. Like I wouldn't feel good about being that kind of person that gets emails from people and just ignores them. Like I can't imagine doing that. But on the other hand, I have good friends that have no problem doing that. So, I don't know, it's just a value system. Like, to me, you know, there's that business concept about the lifetime value of a customer, right? That it's not just about this one transaction. They might walk into your little five and dime shop and buy a candy bar today. But you know what? If you are very nice to them and you provide a good environment and you're friendly, they might start doing more of their shopping and eventually all of their shopping at your corner store. So it's not just about that one candy bar today. Like that person is worth more than this candy bar. They can be a lifetime customer that ends up paying you thousands of dollars over years. So I think of that also in a non-monetary way, that it may just be some random person, I have no idea who this is, some stranger is asking me a question. And I could choose to blow it off, but instead by answering it, it develops a relationship. Even if it's just a very loose, light touch relationship, you know, we often never meet in person. It's just an email. It's just a couple minutes of my time. But you never know what these relationships develop into over the course of many years. So I often think of the lifetime value of knowing someone, even a little bit. And it's worth it to me. So honestly, the main reason I do interviews like this or even going and speaking on stage at conferences is for the people I meet when doing it. You know, the people that reach out to me afterwards saying, hey, I heard of you on the Art of Adventure podcast. I'd never heard of you before. I really love what you're doing. And that's like a great way to meet somebody. You know, there's obviously plenty of people that listen to Art of Adventure that have never, you know, heard of me before. And I love that. So
yeah, here he is. Here, this is Derek Sivers, everyone. You're hearing him right now. What are people asking you most commonly? Are there any big themes?
A lot of career questions, I think, because people know that I sold my company and I often blog about entrepreneurship. I used to do so more in the past. I feel like right now I've said all I have had to say. I don't like talking outside of experience. You know, I like to only talk about things I've personally experienced, not just, you know, spouting what other people should do without doing it myself. You know, so a few years ago, I put out this book called Anything You Want. That was me trying to compress everything I learned in 10 years of starting, growing, and then selling my company, trying to compress it into something you can read in under an hour, like really succinct. You know, of course, I could go on for hours on the subject, but finding a way to compress it down into the most succinct delivery I could. So yeah, that's my book called Anything You Want. That is out on Penguin
and
Portfolio Publishing. So
just read that book. The interview is finished. So everything you need is in there. And
okay, goodbye. No, but so I get a lot of questions about entrepreneurship from people, say, that have read my book or articles. A lot of it is about how do you build your career, or a lot of like, I want to quit my job and follow my passion kind of people, or I don't know what my passion is. What should I do? It's a real pet subject for people. So that's the main gist. But man, I get people like, I don't know, a guy in India asking me how he can deal with his frustrating parents, or people asking me how to break up with their girlfriend, or, you know, how to try to manage my time. I don't know. It's just kind of fun.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Open up my email box and
it's like,
I put aside like an hour a day to just...
You have a newspaper column if there are still newspapers.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about career building. You know, we talked a bit about this, and, you know, you were featured in Cal Newport's book, So Good They Can't Ignore You. And what are some of your thoughts about how to structure a career that leaves you happy and fulfilled?
Have you discussed that book on Art of Adventure before? So Good They Can't Ignore
You? Yeah, Cal Newport was a guest. I can't remember which episode at the moment, but yeah, he came on and we did talk about that book. And probably mentioned that you were in
it. Okay. Such a fan of that book. I mean, yeah, I read it because he... Well, actually, no. First and foremost, I'm a fan of Cal's work. Like, I have been for years. So pretty much anything he does, I'll just read because it's Cal. So he interviewed me for something, and he asked me a bunch of random questions when it was a very vague idea. So a year later, when that book came out, I didn't know I was in it.
Oh, wow.
I just picked it up like, cool, Cal Newport has a new book. And I was reading it. Then suddenly, you know, chapter 9, Derek Sivers. I was like, whoa, I'm in it. So that was a nice surprise. But it's not why I love that book. I really do think that that book is a game changer. It's a wonderfully different way, and a very rational and a very wise way of thinking about your career. And I highly recommend that anybody that is thinking of, you know, quitting your job or following your passion or anything like that, please go get and read the book So Good They Can't Ignore You by Cal Newport. So I often direct people to that book for advice. Like, I'm not a consultant, you know, like I'm not trying to be a know-it-all. I think there's some people that they want to appear smart so that companies will pay them lots of money to be a consultant, but I don't do that. So I have no problem admitting that I'm not that smart. I often defer to sending people to the best advice I've read, you know. So if people are asking me questions, I'll say, you know, that's a really good question. You should read this book. So for career stuff, I think the big lesson from Cal Newport's book, So Good They Can't Ignore You, is to forget this idea of passion and purpose. People just take it as like a truism. It's just a fact that you should follow your passion and find your true calling. And what is my purpose? What is the meaning of life? What is my purpose? And his wonderful point after studying so many careers is that these emotions of feeling passionate or feeling you have a purpose is the result of you working and developing expertise in a path. The work has to come first. You can't just like sit around drinking your beers in Bali, wondering what your purpose is. You've got to really pursue something and be working at something for years often before you really feel the sense of like, you know, I'm an expert in this now and the rewards are starting to come to me for being an expert in something and being valuable to the world. You've got to do the work first before it starts to feel like passionate work that's giving you a sense of purpose. And that's huge, man. That changes everything.
Yeah. And it kind of takes the pressure off having to know your passion, you know, because there are hundreds of people right now probably in Bali drinking beers and trying to figure out what is my passion. And they're just hoping for divine inspiration to strike.
Yeah. I think it's actually a little bit of the downside of affluence, you know, the being able to afford to just sit around wondering what your purpose is. Yeah, there's really something to that work ethic that says, no, you just go get a job, go get some job, any job. It doesn't even really matter what that job is. I mean, ideally it's in a field that has some room to grow, but you can just go get any job in any career and just start focusing on it and learning all there is to learn about it and develop valuable expertise and follow. And then that turns into a fascination. You know, oh, there's this beautiful quote that the ocean gets deeper the more you go into it. Mm. Any field that you're going into, the more you learn, the more there is to learn, right? So, God, there was this guy emailed me once that he was working at, I think, a FedEx warehouse or maybe an Amazon warehouse, probably an Amazon warehouse, like in Virginia or something. Yeah. And he's just like, I hate my dumb job. I just work in a dumb warehouse shipping boxes for Amazon. I'm miserable. What should I do? And I was like, dude, you work inside Amazon. That's amazing. Like, you should be studying the logistics systems they use. Like, that is some cutting edge stuff that's going on there. Like, if I were you, like, man, I would take a minimum wage job at Amazon in the warehouse just to start to learn how the system works. And I would, like, talk to my manager during the breaks and learn, like, how do they decide where things go and how do these systems work and look at the robotics they're using. And like, God, there's so much to learn there. It's not just some dumb job. So, you know, to me, it's like, ever since I was started working when I was 16 years old, the day I turned 16, the day that I was like legally allowed to work, I got a job the first day I was allowed to work. I got a job in telemarketing because I wanted to learn how to get better at selling things. And yeah, I spent a few years doing telemarketing. I think the people sitting next to me just thought of it as some stupid, dumb job. But to me, I was like, no, man, I'm getting better at selling. I'm learning how to do this. And soon I became like the top salesman on the floor. There were like 200 reps on the floor. I was the youngest one and I became the top seller on the floor. And yeah, I did telemarketing for a few years until I felt that I had kind of cracked that nut. And then I took some other dumb minimum wage jobs because they were a path to teaching me other things. So,
well, so there's an important distinction there that, you know, this guy was thinking of his warehouse job as just something that he's doing for money. But you're saying that these jobs are all intentional because there's something you want to learn. It's like an apprenticeship somehow. And I think that's maybe like a mindset distinction that people are, you know, they're getting a lot more than just a paycheck, or you, Derek, are getting more than just a paycheck, and other people are just, you know, they're sort of like trading the time that they wish that they could be relaxing for money instead of learning the system.
I have a core philosophy that I've had ever since that very first job, that you should never work for money. Money should never be the reason you're doing anything. It always has to be secondary. There has to be a better reason than just money. So everything I've ever done has never been for the money. And money can be like a nice measure of success or a measure of achievement or even a measure that you're providing value to the world, you know, but it's never the point. So yeah, no matter what dumb job I was doing, it was always about building my skills. But actually, that brings us into a bigger subject that would be fun to talk about, is present focused versus future focused.
Mm.
There's a book called The Time Paradox by Philip Zimbardo that I highly recommend. In fact, if you go to my book notes page on my website, it's sivers.org/book.
It's right up there at the top.
Sivers.org/book. I sort them with my top recommendations up top. And if you just kind of scroll one page down, I think it's probably like the fifth book listed, is The Time Paradox. And this book changed everything for me because it starts out with the story of the 4-year-olds and the marshmallow. And
yes.
Many of you have heard this, but just in case you haven't, it goes like this. That a few decades ago, they did some studies, some psychology professors at Stanford did some studies where they, one by one, they brought some 4-year-olds into a room and they gave them one marshmallow. And they said, now I'm going to leave the room for a few minutes. If you don't eat that marshmallow, and if you can wait a few minutes, I'll give you 2 marshmallows when I come back. But if you eat that marshmallow now, then that's the only one you get. So I'll be right back in a few minutes. And they had the, you know, the hidden cameras rolling, and they watched the kids, and
they're all squirming.
So they found that, right?
Like, I want to eat
they
it.
Found that across the world, everywhere in different countries, Brazil, Japan, America, about 70% of the kids ate the marshmallow right away. And across the world, only 30% of those kids could wait the full, actually, I think it was 15 minutes to get the second marshmallow. So yeah, those ratios stayed about the same in every country. But here's the interesting part. Is that 15 years later, those researchers followed up and they found that those kids that waited for the second marshmallow were now generally higher achievers. They were all around more successful. They were happier. I think they scored on an average like 250 points higher on the SAT test. And they were just generally higher achievers in whatever field they had chosen, whether it was academic or athletic or artistic. So the point is delayed gratification. The ability to delay gratification is one of the best indicators of future success. And I loved the marshmallow story. I heard that at a TED talk, and then I got the guy's book, and he elaborates much more on this idea of present focus versus future focus being one of those things that kind of like introversion and extroversion, that we all have our nature that just comes to us naturally, but that we can also influence it and change it. You know, you can be painfully introverted or painfully shy, and you can learn how to be a little more outgoing or appreciate the company of others more. And vice versa, if you're one of those people that can't stand being alone for a single hour, you know, you can find ways to learn how to be alone better. So with present focused and future focused, you can learn to change your focus of the world. But to me, it helped me understand all of these present focused people in the world, because honestly, man, I've always been like so off the chart future focused. Everything I do is kind of in service of my future self that I've never even understood why people seemed to like to go out to clubs and party. What is that for? How is that serving their future self? And this book actually helped me understand, like, oh, they're just being present focused. I never thought about that. You know, so yeah, I think it's the same thing. Sorry, we're on a tangent about career paths.
And, yeah, no, yeah, but that's, you know, because you're saying that's probably the majority, some majority of the people. I wish that I had taken the marshmallow test now, because I have no idea whether I was that kid that could hold off on the marshmallow. Probably because I didn't like marshmallows, so I would have been easy.
Yeah, I know. That would influence it. It'd be tough. Like my favorite, you know, mint cookie. Yeah, anyway. Yeah, so I think about this stuff all the time. I think ever since I read The Time Paradox, it's really helped me understand the world and understand other people. And even in myself, kind of questioning, like, is this action I'm taking, is this serving my future self, or is this just some kind of immediate gratification need, you know? Mm.
And so let's talk a little bit about your reading habit, because you read a lot of books, and I think you were one of the first entrepreneurs who I found their book list. Well, there's some other great ones, Gates Notes, Ryan Holiday's, Ty Lopez, they all have a lot of good book recommendations. And there's the idea of is it Charlie Munger who has the multiple frameworks of operation?
Yeah.
Basically, he does a lot of reading. And I was wondering if in all the reading you've done, you're starting to develop some grand theory of the way the world works, or if you're starting to pull interconnections between the different topics that you're reading. Is there anything that's been percolating in your mind about the world from all these books?
Absolutely. Thanks for a lovely segue into the thing that's actually kind of currently fascinating me. My newest blog post on my blog that I just posted a week or so ago. It's at sivers.org/to-do. Let me pull it up now to remember what it's called. It's called Just Tell Me To, Compressing Books Into Directives. Yes. So sivers.org/2, the letter D-O, to do. So yeah, now I'm realizing that I've read and taken detailed notes on 225 books over the last 7 years. And I review my notes often, and kind of initially in preparation for a conference talk I was giving, I thought it would be an interesting challenge to compress everything I've learned from all 225 books, not just into a summary of what I've learned, but how can we actually turn all of those observations into actions? That I think that it's a really useful thing to tell people what to do. You know, it's hard to do. I think it feels weird to tell people what to do, because it feels like, you know, who am I to tell people what to do? But when I think about it,
kind of what they want.
Yeah. Well, it's very useful to others. So who am I not to tell people what to do? It feels like some kind of
humbleness holding you back from being more useful to the world? Because a directive, if you kind of remove some emotions around, you know, telling people what to do, like I'm nobody's boss, all that kind of stuff, like forget those emotions and just think of them as a useful sentence structure. It's called a directive when you say do this. Directives are a very useful sentence structure because instead of just talking around a subject, if you say do this, people can, they don't have to obey, obviously. They can choose to do it or not, but it kind of makes it a more digestible, palatable, useful format for communicating knowledge. You know, like the Ten Commandments, right? The Ten Commandments were not, you know, didn't use up 25 stone tablets to discuss the various pros and cons and issues around the point. They just said, do this, don't do that, don't do this, and do that. It's just a useful way of communicating an idea. And I think the philosophy is actually contained inside the directive, right? So my favorite example of this is Michael Pollan wrote a book called The Omnivore's Dilemma. And I'd heard good things about The Omnivore's Dilemma for a few years, but I just never got around to reading it because it was like, it's 450 pages and it's about like the entire history of food and everything that brought us up to the current point. I thought, I'm just not that interested in the subject. So a couple of years later, he wrote a book called In Defense of Food. And that one sounded a little more appealing. Like now he kind of took everything from his big giant Omnivore's Dilemma book and compressed it into only 250 pages, you know, a much tighter argument. But even then, it's like, I'm not that interested in food. Like, I really don't want to read 250 pages on the subject. So I never got around to it. And then he put out a little tiny, tiny book called Food Rules that you can read in like 30 minutes, maybe 15 minutes. And it compresses everything he's learned from all of his research into just 64 sentences. Each one is just a directive saying, do this. And like, for example, it would say things like, eat only foods that will eventually rot, or avoid food products that make health claims. And I love that. Those are like beautiful little simple rules of thumb that you can use when you're in the supermarket and you're trying to decide what to buy. What should I eat? What should I do? You know, do this. That is so much more useful to me than a big giant 450-page book that discusses all of the issues. So yeah, I started thinking about all of these 220-something books I've read, and maybe it's my chore, my job, to compress everything I've learned from all of them and do some simple do-this style directives for people. So that's a project I'm working on now. I'm not sure what shape it's going to take yet. It's a brand new idea, but it'll just be something I do for the world.
Can you share some of your favorite directives that you've come up with so far?
Oh, yeah. Give me a second. Okay. You want to hear some?
Yeah. All right.
I'll do two of them. I mean, I'll do two sets. I think part of the fun is to categorize them into certain how-tos. So instead of just a whole string of hundreds of directives, you know, you group them together. So for example, here is my one called How to Get Rich. Okay.
Sweet.
How to Get Rich. Live where luck strikes. Live where everything is happening, where the money is flowing, where the careers are being made, where your role models live. Once there, be as in the game as anyone can be. Be right in the middle of everything. Next one, say yes to everything. Meet everyone. Pursue every opportunity. Nothing is too small. Do it all. Like lottery tickets, you never know which one will win, so the more the better. Follow up and keep in touch with everyone. How to get rich. Learn the multiplying skills. Speaking, writing, psychology, design, conversation, knowing a second language, persuasion, programming. Each one of these could be pursued on their own, but really they're best as skills that can multiply the success of your main pursuit. So for example, an airline pilot who's also a great writer and a public speaker, or a chef that has a mastery of psychology, persuasion, and design. Those people will be much more successful than their peers because they've learned these multiplying skills.
Yeah.
How to get rich. Pursue market value, not personal value. Do what pays well. Don't be the starving artist working on things that have great personal value to you, but little market value. Follow the money. It tells you where you're most valuable. Don't try to make a career out of everything you love. For example, sex. How to get rich. Shamelessly imitate success. Imitate the best strategies of your competitors. The market doesn't care about your personal need to be unique. It's actually rather selfless and humble to just use the best ideas regardless of their source so that you can create the best service or product for your clients. Get great at executing other people's ideas just as well as your own. How to get rich? be the owner, not just the inventor. It's tempting to try to be the ideas person, to have someone else do the dirty work of making those ideas happen. But ideas don't make you rich. Great execution of ideas does. It's kind of a rule of capitalism that whoever takes the most financial risk gets the most rewards. So the biggest rewards will always go to those that fund it and own it. So to get rich, you have to be the owner. Own as close to 100% as possible. And lastly, how to get rich? Benefit from human nature. Instead of complaining about the downside of human nature, just find ways to benefit from it. Instead of complaining about the rules, just learn the game and play it.
Wow. That's amazing. There is so much there. Each time you said something, my mind was like, whoa, totally blown.
Right. Okay. So now I can confess that actually I spent 4 months writing like about 100 directives like this, thinking that it was going to be my next conference talk. Like I got asked to do a big keynote speech at this big conference with like 2,000 people, and it was going to be a really high profile thing. I was like, I want to do something new and bold and daring. I'm going to compress everything I've learned in 7 years into a 30-minute talk of directives. And dude, I spent 4 months writing it, and it sucked. When I was all done, I was like, it was like the day before the slides were due, and I was putting my final touch on it, and I started reading it out loud to some friends. I said, can I practice my talk on you? They said, sure, great, can't wait to hear it. And everybody told me it sucked. They're just like, dude, no, it's really bad. You shouldn't do it.
Wow.
And I thought the first friend that told me that was just, you know, stupid. And then my second friend that I tried it on said that. And then I tried it on a different friend that I really, you know, no interest in his opinion. And he's like, no, that's a really bad talk. He said, you're trying to cram in too much. He said, the first 4 minutes were fascinating. And then it was just like, you kept going and you kept going and you kept going. And there was just too much there. Like, I want to talk about each one of those issues. So yeah, I'm getting the idea that trying to compress everything I've learned into 30 minutes is probably unwise. But maybe each one of these things needs to be its own, you know, article, its own blog post. Mm. And then I can link them together into a simple list of do this things with more details if interested.
Yeah, you know, but there is, like you mentioned, the power, the beauty of the simple directive, like in the Ten Commandments, because as soon as you said, you know, like the multiplication of the traits, that one jumped out to me because I was thinking about my friends who are the most interesting people to be around. And I was thinking about their personalities, and they have, you know, multiple intriguing personality traits. So that idea can actually be applied in other different areas. And there's just a whole lot to think about there, you know, they're. Mm. You know, they're the ones, the addictive personalities that you're like, oh my gosh, you tell good stories and, you know, you are really good at strategy and you're really caring. Like you have all these things all in one person, you know, and they're multiplying. Yeah. Crazy.
So the hardest part of this whole project is to take something that's like one of these big psychological studies that have been done, and then one of these books will share their findings. And even they are compressing it down for the sake of making a book that's readable by the layman. They will take these very academic studies and compress it into a few pages of sharing the findings of these studies. But almost none of these books take that extra step of telling you what to do. It's more like, here's our observations about the world. So good luck. Maybe you can put these to use somehow. I hope you enjoy our findings. So I like the idea of just taking that extra step, like saying, okay, well, given this finding, this fact about how the way our minds work, how can I use that? Like, what is the action that I can take or that everybody should take?
Books that had something that you just couldn't figure out how to put into a directive?
Oh, all of them. Yeah. So what I really spent the last 4 months doing was just going through all of my notes for all 220 something books and going to every single point that I had underlined, every sentence, every paragraph, and thinking, how can I turn that sentence or that paragraph or that idea into a directive? So yeah, I mean, 2/3 of them, I just have no idea. But, you know, 1/3 of them or so, I think it'll just be an ongoing challenge for me. I could see this being like something I work on for a few years. I really like it.
That's really a valuable thing I think you're doing. So I salute you for your effort on that. So many people are coming to you for advice, emailing you, and now you have all these directives that you're working on. You know a lot of things, but who do you turn to for inspiration or advice?
Well, I'm going to sound like a total nerd repeating the same tune again, but generally books, because I just have this kind of introverted nature that I really do enjoy one-on-one conversations, but In general, I like the idea of like trying to figure out things for myself. I'm not one to join a group or a mastermind of other entrepreneurs and have a whole bunch of people getting together to talk about things. Like, yeah, I'd rather somebody would write up the conclusions afterwards and I can just read it. You know, so I do turn to books for mentorship. Actually, it was kind of nice to see that James Altucher wrote somewhere. He said, outsource 90% of your mentorship to books. He said, a lot of people are out there like trying to find a mentor. Will you be my mentor? But he said, just let books be your mentor. And maybe I liked that because that's clearly what I've done my whole life. Is I never, almost never had a mentor. I did have just one or two people. You know, Seth Godin was a bit of a mentor to me. And I had one or two people that, you know, just a little bit helped at some key points, more like people that I could call when I was stumped. But for the most part, yeah, I think I find books to be a wonderfully filtered, structured, well thought through, well edited way of communicating an idea.
Yeah. And they're already sort of pre-compressed all their experience, you know, compressed it like you did with 7 years into one book.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I like that. And man, especially the bang for the buck. You know, so one of my dear friends is a real extrovert. And books just don't do it for her. She can't just sit alone on the couch for 9 hours and read a book. She falls asleep. But she loves seminars. And so it's so funny to me that like she will go spend like $15,000 for some very like high-level mastermind seminar put on by this person that also wrote a $12 book. And actually, everything they're saying on stage was in their $12 book. And much more was in the book, actually, that they can't even get to on stage. But she's happy to pay the $12,000 to go to the mastermind seminar because that's just the way that she learns. That works for her more than a $12 book. But I'm thankful that $12 books do it for me.
So you're saying, let's market to the extroverts.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Because you know you're an introvert and I talk about it on your site, is there anything that you found to make you effective as an introvert that you've come to realize?
Good question. Sometimes your friends are very useful for things like this. That when I was living in Singapore for 2.5 years, I put myself very out there. I felt like, well, this is my new home. I want to meet everyone. I am fascinated to be living in Asia now. This is amazing. So it's like I loudly put on my site, like I live in Singapore and everybody that passed through Singapore knew that I was there. And everybody that came through for even just, you know, 24 hours on a layover would look me up and say, let's meet. And I'd said yes to everyone. And then of course, all the Singaporeans, they were there. I ended up having like 500 or so one-on-one get-togethers.
Wow.
Just meeting at coffee shops for an hour or two, 500 times with 500 different people. And I would come home at the end of those days just like exhausted. Say like I'd meet 3 or 4 people in one day, you know, somebody at 10, somebody at noon, somebody at 3, somebody at 5. And then I'd come home at 7 p.m. and my girlfriend would say like, how's your day? And I'd be like, talking all day. I said, like, I met 4 people and I said, like, 2 of them were fascinating. You know, 2 of them were, you know, pick my brain. Is there anything that sounds less appealing than I want to pick your brain? Ugh. You know,
but then on the other hand, practice some dentistry on you real quick.
Right.
Dentistry.
Can I pick your root canals? So sometimes I would come home at the end of the night and she'd say, how was your day? I'd be like, it was amazing. I was programming all day long. I said, I got to my office at like 7:30 this morning and I just dove immediately into this PostgreSQL database thing I was doing. And I figured out how to get the currency conversion to work with the JSON downloaded. I was like, oh, it was amazing. And I got this Ruby thing. I've been wanting to do this for years and I got this all working. Like, oh, what a day. I am like so pumped. And so finally she pointed out, she said, you know, all the days when you come home so psyched about what a great day you had, it was always those days where you just sat alone and were writing or programming all day long. And she said, the days that you come home and you're most exhausted are always the days where you were just like meeting with people all day. I was like, oh yeah. Yeah. Thanks for pointing that out. She's like, why do you keep saying yes to these things if it exhausts you? I went, that's a very good question. And it was shortly after that that I moved to New Zealand because I was actually like just so immersed into Singapore. I was such a part of the scene there that it was just so hard to say no 50 times a week to everybody that wanted to meet with me or invite me to every event or everything. So moving to Singapore was my way of kind of focusing inward. To me, it's like different places represent different things to me. Like you don't always have to make one place your everything. So to me, New Zealand is my inward focused place. And
yeah, because it's hard to get to. I was like, I want to meet Derek Sivers, and I had to hop on a plane, fly really far away.
Yeah, not a lot of people passing through. And so, yeah, but on the other hand, I mean, I'm not, you know, we're not ever like 100% one thing or the other. So I do go back to Singapore. I'm still a legal resident of Singapore, and I'm glad that I am. And I would actually like to live there again someday and kind of balance my time, keep a home in Singapore and spend my time there when I'm feeling like being outwardly focused. Because sometimes those phases last for years even. There was a time when I had like a couple years that I was quite outwardly focused and loved it. Even like my 2.5 years I lived in Singapore, I really did love all that outward focus for about the first 2 years. And then my last few months there, I felt like, I'm a little over it. I think I want to turn inward now. So that's when I moved. So I think it's okay to balance it. So sorry, that was an answer to your question. Like, how do I learn to work with my introvert tendencies? And I think just
That's
you
good.
You have to kind of boldly admit it. So even in Wellington, I'm living in Wellington. When you and I met, I was living on the wharf that was like right in the middle of the city. But now I'm living like off on the outskirts of the city, like right on the ocean, looking at the big crashing waves coming in. So I'm on the edge of town because I don't like living near all the bars and the clubs and the people. I just like to be remote.
Cool. Yeah, it is useful. And feedback from other people can help us realize what we already know, but don't have the perspective. Do you need another podcast to listen to? Not satisfied with 2 times a week of The Art of Adventure? Well, I have an idea for you. My friend Laden Jurcek runs the Travel Wisdom podcast. I've been a guest on the show, and it's awesome. He talks to people about their travels and how travel has impacted their lives. He's a pretty interesting guy. He's been to over 80 countries, only spending $30,000 to make that happen. And he believes, like I do, that travel is an investment in your future. So if that sounds like something that's up your alley, you should check it out, especially if you need help convincing those around you that travel is a good idea. You can find it in iTunes under the Travel Wisdom podcast. I think if I recall when we were chatting, you have residency or maybe citizenship in 3 countries, USA or Singapore, Belgium.
New Zealand, Singapore, and Belgium. Belgium is kind of my, or Europe in general, is kind of my in-between those two things. Like Singapore is total extrovert place. New Zealand is total introvert place. And I found that Europe is kind of a nice balance for me where I'm very just inherently, intrinsically interested in my surroundings because I just don't know Europe that well. I'm very curious about it. But on the other hand, it's a little more spacious there. It's not super dense, Singapore. So it's a kind of a nice balance, a way that you can, or at least I can, be kind of inward focused sometimes, you know, a few days a week, outward focused a few days a week. So yeah, different places for different purposes.
So yeah, let's talk a little bit about location. And I've just come up with a thought experiment that I was going to ask you about, because now we have digital nomads and people that can, you know, you left the States and we can all live wherever we want if we have a portable job. Let's take that to the logical extreme. Can you imagine a world where everyone can teleport to anywhere? They can teleport to work. They can teleport to the grocery store. How would that change people's behaviors and where they choose to live?
Well, I think it's funny that most people love being in the city. Like, they love to be in a place of high entertainment value. Most people like to be entertained. I mean, most people watch TV, you know? They want the world to entertain them. So those of us that don't, I don't need entertainment. I don't really have the need for a city that most people do, but I know that that's a minority opinion. So I'm not going to project my own tastes and say that, hey, if anybody could live anywhere, then they would all live out in the beautiful rural countryside. Because no, the people have spoken, and they don't want to live in the rural countryside. They want to live in the city where everything is happening. I think there are different definitions to this digital nomad thing. I actually just went to a digital nomad conference in Berlin a month ago.
Oh, yeah.
And was surprised to find that we had different definitions of this thing. So a lot of people are legal residents of America or Germany or wherever, and they just want to kind of go backpacking around Southeast Asia while doing some work on their laptop, and they want to go live that life in a hammock for a few years. But ultimately, they see themselves as living wherever they're from. You know, they talk about doing the digital nomad thing for a few years and then coming back or whatever. But to me, like, I have no interest in being somewhere for a short term. I really love moving to a place. Like, everywhere I've lived, I've done the 9 months of paperwork to become a legal resident of a place, you know, and plan on spending many, many years there and even eventually getting citizenship if I can. That's my definition of digital nomad, is I love the fact that I can immerse myself into Singapore for a few years and immerse myself into New Zealand for a few years and Belgium and maybe even stay long term, or you know, maybe I will just continue to have three homes around the world and spend 4 months in each and just keep moving like that. But yeah, I don't see myself ever going back to a place I've lived before. Like, I certainly don't want to live in the place that I'm from. It's like the least ambitious thing I could do. I don't want to live. Been there, done that. I get America. Why would I go back?
All right, cool. And I guess some digital nomads probably haven't decided which they are yet. Kind of like me. I'm not sure.
Yeah. You only know through experience. I mean, you might go hit the road and go spend a few months in Bali, or, you know, spend 6 months in Thailand doing the visa runs every now and then and all that stuff. And you may decide that you love that life. And you may decide that you don't. Even Singapore, for example, I mean, you know, like in Southeast Asia, Singapore is kind of unique in how crazy expensive it is. Yeah. And how clean and developed it is. But what I loved about Singapore is that you could become a local, you know, that Singapore has always been a melting pot of influences, and the British have been there since the beginning. They were the founders of Singapore. Like, there was basically nobody there before the British came in and made it this thing. So it's always had white people as a minority, but still just as local as anyone, you know, that have lived there for many generations. I like the fact that I was completely accepted as a local in Singapore and part of the scene, even if I didn't grow up there. Whereas, you know, I imagine that if you're in a place like Japan or Thailand or Indonesia, you're never like fully integrated. You know, you're always kind of the outsider. I kind of liked that about Singapore, that you really could really make it your long-term home. So my son was born there. So my son actually, he's born in Singapore and he's proud of it. So even here in New Zealand, he's 3 years old, but he'll tell anybody that listens that he's like, I was born in Singapore. I'm from Singapore. And I love the fact that that's like part of his identity. And in fact, what's funny is he's a permanent, both he and I are permanent residents of Singapore, which means that unless something changes, he will have to do 2 years of military duty in the year 2030 for the Singapore military. So I'm into that kind of immersion, you know, not just breezing through and drinking some beers and moving on, but I love to get immersed into a place.
Well, and I mean, beers in Singapore are so expensive. Why bother, you know? Let's see. I want to shift gears real quick and ask you, because you're well known for CD Baby and you were a performer for a long time, and that's probably, you know, what led you into helping so many other artists produce their work. And since you've already written a book about it and you've talked at length about it, I want to just ask you if there was a big shift in your thinking from who you were as a performer to who you were as a CEO, business owner, someone who sold a large business. How do you view the world differently after going through CD Baby?
I never viewed myself as a CEO of a large business. In fact, I think that that was the root of a lot of misunderstandings in how I was running my company, is I was still treating it kind of like an art project or kind of like a band, you know. Like, for example, if you have a band, if you are the songwriter of a band, nobody ever tells you, like, hey man, you should outsource your songwriting to somebody else. Have somebody else write your songs. Because no, it's clear, like, this is your creative outlet. Why would I have somebody else write the songs for my band, right? But yet, as the sole computer programmer of CD Baby, people would often say, like, hey, why don't you just hire some programmers? And that, to me, that was the same thing. Like, why? I would never do that. Like, this is my creative outlet. This is my venue for self-experimentation or self-improvement. Why would I just have somebody else do it? That's silly. That's like, it's like running a marathon saying, hey, why don't you just call a taxi to take you to the end? You know?
Does that miss- Some people would be like, oh, great idea.
Yeah, exactly. The Tim Ferriss shortcut. Hey, here's a hot tip. Here's how to run a marathon in 3 minutes. The 3 minute marathon. Call a taxi. I never really saw myself as that big business CEO. And that was a source of frustration for people that were trying to deal with me or wonder why I was making the decisions I was making. It seemed like I was a quirky oddball, but it's just because I never really considered it to be a business. That's not why I was doing it. It was just helping some musician friends and doing it as a creative experimentation for myself. But so no, I don't see that much difference. I think the main difference, or maybe the only difference, is that from the age of 14 to 29, everything I was doing was me, 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 me. It was like my music, my thoughts, my songs, out there promoting myself. It was all about me. And when I was 29, that's when I started CD Baby. And I guess because I had spent 15 years in me, me, me mode, I was ready to switch. So CD Baby was not about me. It was all about helping my musician friends. It was them, 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 you know, which is funny that people that knew me as a musician would ask like, hey man, so you're still making music? And I'd say, no, like something switched in me. Like, it's not about me anymore. Maybe it's a little bit like the athlete, the former athlete that is now a coach. And it's like that athlete had his day in the spotlight and now he's really ready for his players to take the spotlight. And I felt like that with CD Baby, that was just like, now, you know, I've had my time in the sun or my time in the spotlight, whatever you want to call it. Now it's my time to help everybody else have some of the success that I had or more. And that was a difference in mindset, but definitely not like a CEO business kind of thing. I never adopted that mindset or that self-image.
Gotcha. Yeah. And thanks for the sports analogy. That really helps people like me. Okay, Derek, I've got two questions that I ask all of my guests. The first one is, if you could change or add anything to the world, what would you want the world to have?
More peanut butter. Easier access to peanut butter from all around the world.
I'm right there with you.
Sorry, that's...
Love peanut butter. All right. Second question is, what's your definition of adventure?
I think it has to stretch your self-image. I really like those moments in life where you have a previous prejudice, something that you used to think that you hated, something that you thought you would never do. Like, you have this self-image of like, I am this kind of person. This is who I am. I am not that kind of person. And I love when you change that. You know, to me, like, the adventure is changing who you are. It's like, in the classic definition of an adventure, it doesn't count as an adventure if the hero goes out into the world and comes back exactly the same. No, the way that stories are written is the hero is changed somehow in this adventure. So the definition of adventure to me is the things that change who you are. Even tiny little examples like, okay, so you're in Bali right now, right? So when I first started CD Baby, I was in New York, and almost right away, like only 1 year into it, I started getting some big orders from Indonesia. I was like, whoa, that's amazing. Like, people would come through and buy like $200 worth of CDs and I'd be shipping them off to Jakarta. I was like, wow, who knew that there was like such a market for indie music in Jakarta, Indonesia? How cool. And then I would get one of these big orders every week, hundreds of dollars of CDs, ship them all off, and even the postage cost a lot. And after about 2 months, I got contacted from the credit card companies saying, those are all fraudulent orders, so we're taking the money back from those. Like, I don't know if everybody knows, like, that's how it works, by the way. Whenever there's like fraudulent activity on a credit card, it's the store owner that gets screwed. The credit card owner is protected. You know, they've got their insurance on their Visa card, and the Visa and MasterCard sure aren't going to take any loss. So no, it's the store owner that gets screwed. So yeah, I got really screwed by people in Indonesia over and over and over again, to the point where I was just like, Indonesia, it's a nation of criminals. I hate those people. And I ended up blocking Indonesia completely from the cdbaby.com website. So like, Actually, it let you visit, but it wouldn't let you complete an order. So all those thieves in Indonesia would think that they were getting away with some credit card fraud. It's just that the order would never arrive and I would never charge the card. I would just destroy the order silently without...
They're just wasting their time.
Yes. Okay, so here's the punchline. So now it's 6-7 years later. I'm living in Singapore and some guys in Indonesia invite me to speak at TEDx Jakarta. And or did I? No, I just attended. I didn't speak. Did I? I don't know. I don't remember anymore. but the point is, to me, it was the attending it that changed my life. Is because, oh man, it was the most wonderful outpouring of like Indonesian pride. Those speakers at TEDx Jakarta were like doing amazing work. And it was like, I was like tears in my eyes with like the amazing people doing amazing things. And even like the whole staff and the people that were putting it on, like everybody was just like so cool and so amazing and so brilliant. And it's like, God, it's like that day, it's like I wanted to be Indonesian that day. I was like, I love this country. I love these people. And so ever since then, yeah, I've been a big fan of Indonesia. And I've gone back many times since and I've gotten involved with some universities there and like, and then suddenly I remembered, like I'd actually completely forgotten. It's like, oh yeah, I used to hate this country. I used to have such prejudice. I used to think it was a nation of thieves. Like, wow, I guess I've really changed and opened my mind. And more recently, just 2 years ago with weightlifting, I used to like, because I went to a high school where you were sharply divided between the jocks and the freaks. You know, so there were the jocks and then there were the freaks that were, you know, the people with the denim jackets with Judas Priest and Iron Maiden patches on them hanging out in the smoking area with their Corvettes, you know. And so I was clearly in the freaks category. Long hair, heavy metal patches, hanging out in the smoking area back when high schools actually had a smoking area that was allowed. Those were the days. So, I was anti-jock, right? The jocks were the enemies. So even up until 2 years ago, I would actively make fun of people that spent time lifting weights. I'm like, what a stupid thing to do with your life, to spend your life lifting pieces of metal up and down. What a ridiculous, stupid vanity thing to do. And 2 years ago, somebody, actually a couple different people that I know and respect, kind of showed me that weightlifting is not about vanity or getting big. In fact, weightlifting and bodybuilding are two very different things. And like, you don't have to look like one of those big lunkheads. In fact, like lifting weights is one of the best things that you can do for your skeletal system. And it's just good for your overall health and all that. And I thought, okay, I'm ready to change my mind about this. And so, yeah, I tried it and I love it. It turns out I'm good at it and I really enjoy doing it. So yeah, for the last 2 years, I've been doing weightlifting and loving it. And I think that, wow, I really changed my mind about that. That's a really cool feeling. So long answer to a short question. I think that's the definition of adventure, is going out and changing your mind and changing who you are on a subject.
Those are great stories. And I think that's a special trait, to be willing to change your mind and embrace it when it happens. So I salute you for that. And I, of course, salute you for all the great work that you do and all the thought that you put into the writing that you put that out there and the things you say, conferences and stuff like that. All of us appreciate it. So thank you.
You know, like I said earlier, I mean, the reason I do interviews like this is I think it's kind of cool to meet people that are the kind of people that listen to Art of Adventure. So, if you've made it this far to the end, please send me an email to Derek, D-E-R-E-K, at Sivers, SIVERS.org, O-R-G. And feel free to ask me anything. I answer every single email I get. I enjoy the challenge. Or just say hello.
Awesome. Is there anything you'd like to point people towards where they can find out more about you?
Just my website, Sivers.org. It's all free. There are no ads. It's no commercial. In fact, for those of you that are into this kind of thing, even if you view source, you'll see I don't even do any Google Analytics or tracking. There are no cookies. It is just a totally non-commercial, static, free site that I just enjoy doing to share my thoughts. So yeah, hit Sivers.org and that has everything.
Perfect. Boom. Well, Derek, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate
you. Yeah, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. We will talk
soon. Okay, see ya.
Bye-bye. Hope you guys enjoyed that episode with Derek Sivers. I am not just a big fan because he has the same name as me, but I feel like I could just sit and listen to him talk for hours. He is one of the greatest thinkers of our day, you know, he's in a great position to do it. He says he doesn't like to talk about anything that he doesn't have experience with. Well, luckily he has a lot of experience. I hope you think about some of those directives that he shared with us about getting rich. I'll have some links to another one of the talks he gave about some of those directives. Check out his website. There's a lot of great articles, straightforward, simple thoughts on there. Yeah, you know, I first got in touch with him by sending him an email. He offered the same for listeners of The Art of Adventure. If you like, if there's something that you think he is the man that could answer this question, give him an email. He's a great guy. I'm just, again, so thrilled to have him on the show. Really appreciate all his work. So if you like this interview, if this is your first time listening to The Art of Adventure, or if you've been listening for a while now and you're not subscribed, I would love it if you would subscribe in iTunes or Stitcher. And if you're so moved, leave a review and let me know what you think of the show, what you thought of this interview in particular. If you have any questions for me or the other Derek, you can leave them there. You can send me an email, derek@derekloudermilk.com. It's been a pleasure talking to you guys today. Now go out there and be adventurous.